It's an interesting one. Again, the five faculties are qualities of mind that, when nourished and nurtured, arise, lead to insight and to understanding. And understanding, of course, then ultimately leads to freedom of mind and releasing of the heart. And so it's interesting that the Buddha would include faith as one of those qualities that releases the heart, releases the heart. Now, as I mentioned last week, we have been sort of stuck in a particular representation of faith that isn't what the Buddha's teaching is pointing to at all. It's not a devout, a blind faith. It's not a faith in some god or something external. But it's more of a verb, an activity. It's hard to talk about it. It's a little bit like trying to talk about awareness or something that's invisible. It's more easily spoken about in terms of what one does to access faith. And we could talk about surrender, which I did last week. Letting be, letting go. And the act, you can feel it in the act of releasing. It's not like monkey bars where we're releasing one bar, but we've got another bar in sight. It's releasing the bar. Now what? You see? You feel it? I love that. Free fall. So tonight I want to talk about specifically the faith to doubt, the faith to trust. Because I think some of us have very deep-seated inhibitions to trust. And what we have built around those inhibitions is a very strong, imposed empowerment, which often is seen as our tendencies towards control and influence. And so when we bring up the word faith in relationship to the tenacity of our control, we're in very shaky ground. Don't particularly like the word. It feels threatening to us. So we'll go into that tonight. We'll look at that. And the faith to doubt, the faith to doubt. Now, those of you who are familiar with the five hindrances know that doubt is one of the hindrances. Doubting, oh, can I do it? Am I up to the task? Is this even worth doing? That's not the doubt I'm suggesting that faith moves towards. Rather, this is the doubting of conventionality, the doubting of established conformity. And it's hard to talk about this without sounding like a bumper sticker. But it's the willingness to question. To question. Not in an anti-authority posture. That gets very tiring. You know, it's just another position. We're not establishing a position in questioning. We're establishing wonder. Is this true? It's not said with an attitude. It's said with genuine wonder. Is this true? That's the questioning. That's the faith element of doubt. The faith to doubt. The faith to doubt. I mean, when you ask yourself some of the fundamental questions, you have to have something. I mean, why would you ask? Is life meaningful? Why would you ask, is there a God? If you're not coming from a position in that, and you're coming from wonder, if you're coming from questioning, because there's no, what if it turns out to be no? Then the monkey bar is not there, you see? That's why it takes faith to doubt. And again, faith is courage. It's confidence. It's assurance, but not insurance in. It doesn't move that way. It isn't one thing to another. And now many of us have sacred beliefs. Beliefs that are so entrenched in us, that are so hidden and encapsulated in fear, that we won't touch them. We have family beliefs like that. Just think of some of yours, where you fear the mind to go, where the topic is never approached around the dinner table, where something is always left unsaid. Doesn't your family have those? Culture has those. The culture has those. Family has those. Intrapersonally, we have them, those issues. One of the ones that we've been bringing up in the culture, about the culture, is the market, how the market feeds on our wanting, feeds on our desire. Feeds on it, needs you to want, needs you to desire. And the implications of that is that from your desire, your wanting, you will feel inadequate, but it needs you to feel inadequate so that it can keep the whole motor of its mechanism in motion. So that's, you don't hear a lot of Wall Street. You hear greed is good, not the other side of the issue. In family, it can be around abuse, or it could be incest, or it could be some of these hidden, sexual dysfunction, something. Or intrapersonally, where is our deepest fear? Our deepest fear. You see, where does our longing for freedom meet our deepest fear? How does it meet it? Because nothing can remain encrusted, calcified, hidden to that longing. Sometimes I suggest people on retreats who have seen very deeply into their personal issues, issues that normally wouldn't come into consciousness because they have such a fear base. But on retreat, they do. And it becomes obvious to the people what action they need to take in relationship to this particular difficulty. And then I will see them on retreat the next year or some other year, and the same issue would have arisen, and the same understanding of what they need to do, and nothing would have been done. Now, not everybody is that way. But it just shows how, in the vulnerability of our awareness, we can expose these fears. But we don't have the faith that in moving in towards its exposure and towards activities that are in opposition to that fear, that there's any safety. Any assurance for us. And really, one of the reasons we get involved in meditation is to solidify our assurance. This is the projected reason, not the real reason. This is what people think will happen. That once I understand my mind, I'll be in more control. And we then build our spiritual lives from the same brick and mortar and hard sweat that we've built our employed lives. And with that same tendency, because it's true in every facet of our life, we still move with what's where the risk is less obvious, where the assurance is greater. Because when I ask myself a fundamental question about a particular area of myself that is held in fear, that produces a crisis. There's a crisis there. When I say, for instance, if intimacy, I had a lot of fear around intimacy, when I bring that up, why would I want to bring it up? All I can see is the pain of my dysfunction. I have no faith that there's anything other than that. And when we bring up the depths of spiritual questions, like who am I? Whoa. Why would we go there? What's the answer going to give me? Nothing. Literally and figuratively. We have to go there on something else. We have to go there in a different way than the monkey bar of certainty. Something else drives this boat. Something else asks that question. Something else forces that question into our consciousness, really. The mind doesn't want it. And our fear certainly doesn't want any aspect of it. And yet there the question is, who am I? Because the greatest of all fears we hold is the fear of non-existence. Sometimes projected as death, often assumed as being negated or being nothing. And so we constantly try to build our lives, our roles, our image, our status up from that sense of nothingness that we most fear. And most of our lives are in the direction of that. And then all of a sudden we come into spirituality, a truly spiritual method, and examine that very creation we spend our whole lives doing. We must be insane. So what drives that, you see? What's the if it was just full of risks, full of fear, no one would go. No one would take a step. But there's something else, some other sense we have, that though we fear nothing, we fear that we are nothing, there's something back there, something sensed, not experienced, intimated. I can't get my hands on it. But it stirs us, doesn't it? What is it? And the more we practice, the more we are assured. We become convinced. It's not like we become convinced in something because we can't experience, but we have a sense, and we get more convinced of that sensing, the faith to doubt. And it's doubt, the willingness to question, which is what I'm called doubting, that has led us to that. So what we're pointing towards is an abiding faith, where we left off last week. Not a blind faith, where I just believe because I really want to believe in something, and I just really want to believe in something, so I'll believe in you. I'll believe in this thing, and I'll just because I really want to believe. See, that's insecure. That's fear. That's coming from fear. Faith doesn't come from fear. Faith has nothing to do with fear. Faith is verified. I was in a scene once, in a spiritual scene, 20 years ago, that a very strong charismatic teacher. And he, a lot of insight was occurring, but something was a little off. It was just a little off. And so I just decided to leave. I got what I needed, and now it's time to go. And when I decided to leave, suddenly what was off became real obvious because everyone started to blame me for leaving. Oh, you're leaving because of your own ignorance. You're just ignorant. That's why you're leaving. And look what you've done to the teacher in your leaving and all this. You see, when a door doesn't move both ways, there's something wrong. You can get in, but you can't get out. It's like Venus flytrap. So that's a sign. When something's not inclusive, that's a sign. There's a lot of signs here, but you get brought in, right? The pedal of the flytrap looks good, so you land on it, and suddenly, if you don't have verified faith, if you just got in because of blind faith, you're trapped. In fact, some people left after I left. One of them tried to commit suicide because that's how much it brought him down to his sense of impotency. And even for me, and at this point I've been sitting for 10 years, it was 6 months before my head was above water. Six months of almost continuous pain. That's how powerful that some of these connections are. But you see, because it was verified faith, that's what saved me. I spent 10 years practicing. I knew when something was off, and I was willing to move out of it. And the difference between the blind faith, in which you have no reserve, and verified faith, where you have reserves, was never more obvious. Someone wrote, "Life is not about success, it is about faith. I may not be successful, but I can be faithful to what I know is true." I like little things like that. That's a sense of integrity, of verified faith. Okay, I'm going to be... Just trust what you know. Trust what you know. And the clamor that arises from a scene after you leave is because of blind faith in those that are left. Because anyone's departure accesses their own doubt. And I'm not talking about the great doubt. I'm talking about... Oh, I have nothing to hang on to anymore. Now, each of us come to meditation with our medley of opinions and views and beliefs. And we each have our direction and what we want out of it. And we kind of get in there as like we're picking a car, choosing a car. Volvo, no, it's too expensive. This one's relatively, $5 a night, I can afford that. So we get into our BW, Vipassana, mobile. And the teaching tries to break down these obstructions. That's what the point of it is. Our beliefs, our certainties. And we fight it. We battle it. Just a story that comes to mind. I spent the first couple of years of my spiritual unfolding very deeply in the Hindu tradition, where I was doing yoga and pranayama and staring at candle flames and standing on my head and doing a lot of things like that. And then I went into the Buddhist meditation center and I said, I don't care what they do, I'm not going to change my Hindu ways. And I just came in with that shell, and then very slowly they just started to drop away. So that's the same thing. We come in with our shell, things that we're willing to kind of let go of because they hurt, and things we're not willing to let go of at all because they shake us too much. So we, okay, and we come in kind of skeptical, which is fair enough, and then you sit. And you do nothing, basically. I mean, we try to get you to do nothing. We probably spend a lot of time doing something as we get to the point where we can do nothing. But basically, the instructions are to sit. And the onion peels itself. And we may get up and run around catching the skins and gluing them back. But the process continues. And each time something falls off, it's refreshing. It's refreshing. Much to our surprise, it's actually refreshing. And sometimes you can almost physically feel something, a burden just. And a role or an assumption or a sense of identity or a positionality or a fear or a wanting or and basically the practice is governed by faith. Nothing is forcing the letting go. It's the experience that I don't need it anymore. Not to need something is to relinquish it. To relinquish it is to fall into faith. I love this quote by Abraham Lincoln. He said, I have been driven many times to my knees by the overwhelming conviction that I have nowhere else to go. That's faith. That's faith. And that's what the practice does. That's where the practice takes us. We don't have anywhere else to go. Are we going to go back and be greedy? Well, I'm going to go back and be selfish. I don't like this compassion stuff. You see, it's a one-way road. And each way, but you never consider going back. I mean, that's not even an option. It's not even an option anymore to turn around. It's an option of how fast I'll walk. But it doesn't matter how fast we walk. Everybody that walks, no matter what speed, makes it. So that we know less and less about where we're walking to. We know very much about where we're walking from. Well, we have less and less of a sense of direction, really. In fact, Narayan, who will be talking here in a month's time, says that the practice is none of your business. It's none of your business where you're going or how well you're doing in getting there. See, that's faith. That's faith. You see, and you stop worrying about destination. You enjoy the beauty of the going. Yeah. Yeah. And what we find is that the application of faith is patience. It's like this poem about waiting. The teacher told me to wait. But I got a lot of questions. And so what's the waiting? It's not waiting in time. It's not waiting for this to get over. Because every time we do that, we are negating faith. See, I can only talk about it. Isn't it interesting? It's like I can describe an elephant by the trunk, but there's not something that sums up faith. So I talk around it, and hopefully by the end of two lectures, you have a sense of the form that it is. You see? So patience, you might say, is applied faith. It puts the heart on the line. Not waiting outside for your husband or wife to get off work. Not that kind of patience. It's the patience of just being, of knowing, not knowing, of having no ambition in the moment. The moment comes in patience to meet you. So patience is born of trust. Just trust. Don't you feel a sense of trust? But you can't say, I trust. You can't. You just begin to trust. It's just a feeling. Yeah, it's okay. I mean, I can relax. It's the ability to relax is faith. I don't have to be so nervous. I don't have to be so tight. What am I so tight about? Why does all this upset me so much? Why am I so in a hurry? It's okay. It just works its own magic. And I can't describe it. I can't plot it. I can't define that. I can't point to it's his or her magic. It's just there. And it's no more in anyone else than in me. And so you see, when we begin to understand that all of our experiences, we can't trust. I'm sorry, but I can't trust experience to give me any kind of reliable guarantee. I can't trust that it's not going to rain. I can't trust that my clutch won't go out. I can't trust experience. So that isn't where faith abides. It doesn't abide within experience. You see? I mean, you might be mean to me. I can't trust that you aren't going to be mean to me. So I don't lose faith because of the experience. Why? How can that be? How can it be that no matter what the experience is, I can still have faith even if the experience is untrustworthy? See, that's the conflict. We have put our faith in experience. We just manipulate it, flex our influence enough, we can make sure that the room is exactly the temperature, that I have an umbrella in case it rains, and that I have an extra clutch in my trunk. And then something happens, doesn't it? And then we get old. Well, there's Botox. See, you can't try. There's no. You can't confirm anything through experience. Experience will never confirm faith because it won't confirm anything but your mistrust. And you're right to have mistrust of experience because there's nothing guaranteed. So when we fall back from holding on to experience as our guarantor, we fall back into what's true, to where faith really resides. But as long as we are fixed upon the expressions and appearances and forms and experiences of life to hold and to mold and to support and to encourage and to give and to access, well, then we have praise and blame and gain and loss and on and on. And that's just the way life is when lived in dependency of experience. But as we sit in meditation, what happens is that we become less enamored by experience. Last sitting was good and this one's not so good, so what? Next sitting, I can't find my breath at all. That's okay. You just patience, you see. And all of the different expressions of the meditation, they come and they go, and I'm hard, I'm hurting, and now I'm joyful, and I'm rapture. This must be it. This must be it. And I sit down again and I'm miserable. And I sit down and my thoughts are just like bowling balls. All of it. And slowly, slowly, less dependency on the unreliable. That I can't reach out and confirm the validity of my meditation through the experiences I'm having within it. I can't substantiate myself as a good meditator because I'm having this or that experience, because next time I don't. And so suddenly experience sort of falls from the foreground to the background. It doesn't matter so much what experience we're having in the minutes we're sitting. So what comes into the foreground? I know this image I've used many times, but I only have so many images of the Hindu statue of Shiva, in which there is a multi-armed god Shiva standing on the back of a human being, and the human being is hunched over staring at a leaf. So the man is steering the little leaf and the Shiva is standing on the man's back. And the point of the statue is that we're so fixed in the expressions and appearances of life that we miss the fact that God is on our back. That we are so enamored with foreplay that we miss the faith, the totality. I once was visiting Nisargadatta Maharaj in 1980. I was a monk and I went to his gathering. He wrote I Am That, and I had read I Am That, and I was just absolutely dumbstruck by the Dharma in that book. So I went to him in Bombay, India, and he had me sit down in front of him, and he then played with me for a number of days, and every day he told me to sit right there, and then he would talk to me about my practice, and he would look interested. And then one day I sat there without his telling me to, and he says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I thought we were going to engage in dialogue." He said, "No, I'm through with you. You go back to the back of the room. And furthermore, I don't want you to say anything to me unless you can say something wise, because all you've been giving me is garbage." And so I would sit in the back and raise my hand when I thought I had something wise to say. You know how successful that is, right? And finally he said to me, "You know, you can cultivate your sense of influence and control, which is what your practice, what you've been telling me your practice has been." Because I was doing it myself. I was like, it was handmade, sculptured practice. Everything, I got it all down together. Or he said, "Just come over here to the truth. Let it grab you, let it envelop you, and release yourself from all of that control." He says, "But I think you'll have to spend 20 more years before you get to that." And 20 more years is what I had to spend. So it's not an easy juxtaposition. It's not an easy transition. It's not an easy to go from self-assertion to patience, from influence to faith. It's not easy. I think that's one of the reasons it brings me into the community instead of teaching long and arduous retreats. If we can learn it here, we can learn it anywhere. And it's all around us. The messages are there for us. We can do this. We can. But what blocks us often is the mistrust we have. Many of us have deep-seated mistrust. We just don't trust. We have had scars in our life, in our childhood or in our adult life, in which many of us have sort of ruled out half the population. All men are. All women are. Can't trust. We've given up. Many of us have given up. And so our practice is built upon self-assertion, self-control. And that'll only take us so far. It's not the final answer, the final solution. It's me sitting in robes before Nisargadatta. I didn't trust him. He's an old man that wanted my robes. when I left his I was leaving. I was downstairs and he was upstairs, and his attendant came down and I said I wanted to offer some money to him. Quite a large amount of money, I thought. It was maybe I don't remember how much it was, but for Indians it was a huge amount of money. Let's say it was 1,000 rupees or 10,000 rupees. And so I said, I'd like to offer this amount of money. And the attendant went back up and started talking to Maharaj, and they were arguing back and forth. And then the attendant came down somewhat sheepishly and said, Maharaj will not accept any check less than $10 million from you. You see what he's saying to me? You see that? How much are you going to pay for this, you see? What? So I thought that was so integritous. I mean, that just more than almost anything else that happened, I left there just reeling. And what he did for a living, he sold Indian cigarettes. So how do we learn to trust? How do we learn to trust? How do we do that? We start with a question. We start questioning. That's how we learn to trust. Not with an assumption, but with true wonder. We start questioning our resistances. Does life have to be like this? That's a question. Do I have to live like this? Because that's the feeling of mistrust. Tight, tense, paranoid, anxious. Do I have to live like this? Is a legitimate question. From faith, that question comes. There must be another way, although I don't have any idea what it could be. This is not working. This is not working is the avenue out, not the avenue towards despair. It's the avenue towards faith. This isn't working. Release, release. So we develop a new understanding of the problem through just seeing. Okay, let me just look here and see. The more we see, the more we allow ourselves to release, the more our faith is verified. In faith. In faith it's verified. Releasing is faith. We verify in faith. And we find we don't have to trust anything that's not in front of us. Because life is always in front of us. It's always in the now. It's always here. It's never in abstraction. So I learned, well, I can handle this. I can handle the now. I can handle the moment, the present moment. I can handle what is. Not the experience. I can't handle whether it's going to rain or not. But if it rains, it's okay. That makes it workable. If I have pain, okay. If I grow old, okay, I can grow old. Now it's not on. Dependency isn't on the level of experience. It's on something else. And that something else just keeps, okay. Through opening, through non-resistance, through allowance, through release, we find ourselves in faith, in faith, in faith. Sometimes we sit here and we can feel it in the room. How can that be? Let's sit for a minute or two.